conference record has joined the conference.
Hi everyone, this is the EPA Brownfields RLF webinar on the RLF fine print. We're going to allow people to start to join right now, and we'll get started probably in about 6 or 7 minutes. I did want to check and make sure that our presenters are on. Jessica Dominguez, I saw you had signed on to Adobe Connect. Are you also on the phone yet? Okay, what about Monty? Okay, I'll check back in a few minutes. Hi, folks that are just signing on. This is the EPA Brownfields RLF webinar. We will get started in about 4 minutes. Just a reminder to please mute your phone, and we'll get started shortly. And I'm just uploading the slides right now to the Adobe Connect. So if you don't see them, just give us a couple more seconds and it should pop up for you. Okay, thank you. everyone. This is Megan Quinn at EPA Brownfields Headquarters. We will give everyone about one more minute, and then we will go ahead and get started. The slides are now up, so you should be able to see them if you've logged into Adobe Connect.
Megan, Monty Hillman here. Can you hear me?
Hi, Monty. Yeah, thanks so much.
Wonderful.
We can hear you. And then let me check. Jessica Dominguez, are you on?
I am on.
Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
Thank you. All right. Well, in the interest of time, since we have a lot to cover and only an hour to do that, go ahead and get started. I'm going to go ahead and force mute everybody. So for the speakers, to unmute your phone, just hit #6 when it's your turn to speak. But I'm going to go ahead and mute all of the lines right now, so you'll hear that in just a second.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press #6.
So can everybody hear me? Let's see. Monty, could you unmute your phone and just let me know if you can hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, I got you.
Okay, great. All right, just wanted to make sure folks could hear. Okay, so thanks, everyone, for joining us. This is our sixth in a RLF webinar series that we put together. We try to do 3 or 4 a year that try to bring this RLF grantee community together to listen to other experiences. We try to of your fellow grantees, and we also try to ensure that we are covering items that are of interest to you. So if you have a topic that you would like us to cover, please do not hesitate to shoot me a note. You can just enter it into the little chat function to the left of your screen in Adobe Connect, or shoot us an email, or let your project officer know, and we will gladly put together a webinar presentation on topics of interest to you. So today we're going to do the Revolving Loan Fund fine print, and we call this the fine print just because there's a lot of smaller but very important, unique requirements that are part of administering an RLF grant. And this was a requested topic from one of your fellow grantees. So we appreciate the suggestion. And we have a lot to cover in a short period of time. So I wanted to let folks know that these slides will be available afterwards. And while we will pause for questions, if there are other questions that come up later, this should be an ongoing dialogue. So please don't hesitate to reach out to myself or one of the speakers or your RLF project officer to get more clarity on any questions that you have. So just a reminder that I have force muted everybody's phone. So you can unmute your phone by hitting #6. To ask a question when we pause for questions, or you can also just submit a question in the little chat box on the left-hand part of your screen, and I'll look at it and shout it out to the presenters. So with that, we're going to go ahead and get started. And this is our agenda today. There is a lot that we are going to try to cover. I'm going to quickly go over the checklist. Jessica Dominguez in Region 1 will talk about climate adaptation analysis and considerations that you'll have to take into account under your RLF grant. Then we'll have Monty Hillman from St. Paul Port Authority talk about his experiences in the RLF and the National Historic Preservation Act. I'll give very high-level overviews on the Endangered Species Act and Davis-Bacon considerations and how they apply to your RLF projects. And then we'll wrap it up with Frank Gardner in EPA Region 1, again, talking about ACRES and some of your reporting requirements. So this first topic, I just want to briefly go over, and in the interest of time, I won't even show it
to you, but just let you know that it is available. So over the years, EPA has put together a sort of lengthy, I think it's 6 pages, checklist, but it's really all of the considerations that you as an RLF grantee will need to take into account before you issue a subgrant or loan. So we will post this checklist after this webinar at that link that you see there. It's not posted yet, but it will be when these slides are posted. And this is not a substitution for working with your EPA PO, but is meant to kind of walk you through all the various steps along the way that you'll need to consider before issuing that subgrant or loan. The items that we're going to cover in the subsequent slides here are items that are listed on this checklist. And again, we kind of refer to them as the fine print, as sort of the things that you may not be totally aware of that you need to consider when making that loan or subgrant or administering your RLF program. So that's the checklist. Again, not meant as a substitution. You still need to check in early and often with your project officer, but it is meant to help you organize your loans and subgrant executions a bit more so there aren't any surprises down the road. So with that, we wanted to start with the very one of the very first, and this is actually a newer consideration to take into account when you're issuing your loans and subgrants. So Jessica Dominguez is going to walk us through this, and Jess, I can move your slides, or you can.
Let me just see. Can I really do that?
See if you can.
I'm seeing if I can, and if I can, I will do it.
Okay.
I think I can. Great. Thanks, Great. Megan. So as Megan just said, this is a relatively newer requirement in the world of fine print and RLFs. But it is a requirement now for both our RLF grants and our cleanup grants. And it's to consider climate change, forecasted climate change, in your cleanup alternatives analysis. But really, where does it affect? It really should be something, if you're going to be effective in considering climate change adaptation, it really fits in all stages of your project and your grant project, from proposal through reporting, because you want to have a qualified environmental professional on board who knows where to look for climate change data, who knows how to look at a site for vulnerability, and also even when you're selecting sites for a loan or subgrant, having some criteria or someone on board who knows how to look at a site to see it from an investment point of view if it has any sort of vulnerabilities. But most importantly, it is an ABCA consideration. That's where the requirement is now in the grant program. So in an ABCA or analysis of brownfields cleanup alternatives, that is not new. That's something that always has to be done with the cleanup investment in our program. You consider the effectiveness, cost, and implementability of remedial alternatives for a particular site. For the climate change impacts, this really speaks to the effectiveness portion of that evaluation. For each alternative that you have, how effective is it going to be in light of forecasted climate change for the particular area and location that you're in? It can also be considered after you've selected a preferred alternative based on effectiveness, cost, and implementability as part of something that has been around for kind of a longer period of time with our program, which is kind of the green and sustainable remediation. That's really something to be done after you choose a preferred alternative through the ABCA analysis and optimizing that. But what the change is now is that it's now a requirement in the effectiveness evaluation portion. So as I said, it's a new term and condition for cleanup and RLF grantees starting in FY13, and in an effort to provide some more support, so it's not just a term and condition without any way of informing you of what we mean, there's a new guidance document and checklist that has been developed recently and is available to you. So the term and condition states that an evaluation of alternatives must consider the resilience of remedial options in light of reasonably foreseeable changing climate conditions. And this is really going to vary depending on where you are in the country and even the specific location you are in your area of the country. It may be sea level rise, may be flooding, it may be drought, but all of this really affects things like permeability, soil structure, erosion, everything that can really affect the protectiveness of particular remedial alternatives. And also just a note, as RLS supplemental funds are awarded, older agreements will also now receive these updated terms and conditions. So if you're a longer-term RLS grantee, you get supplemental funds, you will also need to comply with this term and condition. So this is an excerpt. Like Megan, I didn't want to provide the whole checklist, but it is just a two-page document. But these are kind of the three checks that we're asking you to go through. And then to simplify that even further, this is really what we mean. First, you identify the observed and potential change in climate conditions for the region and locations you're in. Based on existing information, we're not asking you to do collecting additional data or doing studies, but based on what's available to you, to make that consideration. The next one is to identify the risk factors specific to your cleanup site. So you know what's kind of going on for your region. If flooding is a concern for your region, what is the concern? Are you in a flood zone? If you're at a high elevation and flooding is the primary risk for the area of the country that you're in, maybe that's not a concern for your cleanup site. And then evaluate how well each cleanup alternative can accommodate the identified climate change risk factors. And these three steps need to be documented and a consideration of each in your APCA that is developed. And this is just an example of some of the existing information that is out there. This is from the National Global Climate Change studies that are out from the federal government. They have reports out for each region of the country. They also have reports on kind of specific things that are kind of more common concern for all climate change. This is a figure from their report on concerns in coastal regions under climate change forecasts. And so it's just really interesting to kind of see the change in sea level rise, kind of the range of forecasts that are out there. But regardless of the extremity, I think it's safe to say it's a concern for much of the coastal area of the country to be considering. And I know at least in the Northeast, we have a whole lot of industry in shipping areas and everything along the coast that we deal with in our brownfields program. So sea level rise will certainly be something that our grantees will be needing to keep in mind. And then this is kind of examples of some of the things that are on the checklist right now to kind of give you an idea of what's out there on a national level for existing data. But I would also encourage anyone making these considerations to talk to their municipal and regional governments or planning organizations, because a lot is being done to try and fine-tune kind of local data and plans that might give you a better idea of what is specifically going on or not going on for the location of a given project. And I believe that is everything for me.
Yes, thank you, Jessica. That was really helpful. And I put Jessica's contact information just on the last slide here. But let's pause here for just a minute and see if there are any questions for Jessica on this first RLF fine print issue.
Hello?
Hi, we can hear you.
Hi, I just wondered if you could clarify for me, as a grantee that was funded in 2011, mm-hmm. Are these considerations required of my current grant, or are they recommended that we begin to incorporate them, or is it only at this point for the new grantees?
If you have anyone from headquarters who needs to clarify, but my understanding is that if you're a 2011 grantee and you have not received any supplemental funding, it is not a requirement. We would, I would recommend if I was your project officer not to ignore the fact if a project is in a flood zone or something like that. It should certainly be a consideration, but it's not something that you need to clearly document as a requirement of your terms and conditions. However, if you get supplemental funding, then yes, at that point, it would be a requirement for you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any last questions? And thanks, Jessica. Yep, that's just what we would say. Any last questions on this issue before we move to NHPA? Okay, thank you, Jessica. All right, so now up is Monty. Monty, can you work your slides yourself, or would you like me to move through them?
It seems like I can click through them.
Okay, great.
Well, hi, everybody. My name is Monty Hilleman. I'm the Vice President of Real Estate and Development at the St. Paul Port Authority. On the slide there, you see my phone number and contact email. If you want to follow up with questions, I'd be happy to help you. The Port Authority's been around for about 80 years. We are created by the state to manage the Mississippi River Harbor here in St. Paul. And in the 60s, we were granted some additional statutory powers to move inland and start doing redevelopment. So we've effectively been cleaning up brownfields since the 60s. I've been here for the last 10 years doing brownfield acquisition, redevelopment, cleanup, remediation, infrastructure, all the way through selling these sites to an end user. We're an economic development agency. We focus on jobs and tax base as the outcomes necessary for us to get involved in a project. And we typically buy the last dregs of what's on the real estate market that the market cannot pencil out a return on and figure out what to do with some of these sites. So we've been an RLF grantee since 2003. We've have several million dollars of successive competitive round and supplemental awards. I think currently I'm up to about $3.5 million in RLF loans into the project I'm going to tell you about today. And it's the old 3M main plant headquarters. This was 3M Corporation's world headquarters from 1907 to about the mid-50s. They, in the 50s, really started building their expansion facility, their new headquarters, out in the suburbs about 10 miles east of this current facility. But this was home to the world's largest sandpaper plant, the world's largest tape plant at one point in time. And the map you see in front of you depicts the buildings as little black boxes there. And what this meant for us, 3M brought this site to the marketplace in 2008. They thought they had a $30 million gold mine on their hands. And after 18 months in the marketplace, they came to us and said, "We can't sell this dog. Will you please, please buy it?" This was 46 acres. In a very dense urban neighborhood along a new light industrial boulevard where the railroad tracks are shown here running east-west. So a very attractive redevelopment site for us, a very large plot of land, but it was 46 acres that was occupied by 1.5 million square feet of buildings. The buildings represented on this map consisted of everything from 1 to 2 story industrial facilities with 14-foot to maybe 17-foot clear height in some cases, 20-foot column spacing. There was an 8-story office tower out here. There were a couple of 6-story warehousing, shipping, receiving plants that, again, were designed for vertical manufacturing, which we just don't really see in the real estate market these days. This map actually is probably a good place to start the NHPA stuff. If you see in the lower left-hand corner, the map reads Phase 2 Architectural History Survey, So that's the type of study. We're all used to phase twos being environmental. Well, in the world of historic preservation, they've got phase twos also. And the phase two survey is what identifies these potentially eligible features. And when I say eligible, we're talking about the National Register of Historic Places. And it's this sort of map that helps you identify what you might be getting yourself into. If you see over on the right part of the map, the words recommended boundaries for 3M Main Plant Historic District. Well, that's about all it takes to get you pretty far into the soup here. The fact that there was a study done out here, we had a federal undertaking, this study that already existed showed that there was a recommended eligible historic district for the National Register. That's what really kicked the whole thing off. And this has been, you know, 5 to 7 years of my life I will never get back. I got to click the arrow here. So, basics for the Preservation Act. At some point here, Megan and the folks at headquarters know better than I if it's at the very instigation of an RLF project, or if it's not until we understand what the ramifications of that phase two survey are. But eventually, EPA has to notice SHPO, your State Historic Preservation Office, of a federal undertaking. You got to remember, this is a federal undertaking of the EPA through your project. So really, it helped me to think, and you know, you understanding it as a professional is one thing, but then having to explain it to credit committees and board members and management, and some of this stuff gets a little squishy, and so I've tried to boil it down as much as I can to help you in explaining it, not just to yourselves, but also to others. So basically, you wind up acting more or less as EPA's proxy because you or your subgrantee or loan recipient, et cetera, your project is the one that's causing all this drama, and you're really helping EPA in a state, federal, and local consultation to help EPA fulfill its obligations under the National Historic Preservation Act through what's called a Section 106 review. That word consultation is in quotes because that's really what this is about. This is about a series of discussions. It's a process largely driven by letter writing. There'll be a lot of letters from SHPO to your regional folks and from US EPA region, whatever, back to SHPO. And the letters matter. They really do. So they really document the consultation. And you know, this process, and I will apologize to any, you know, hardcore preservation advocates on the phone. We're a development agency, and so we are trying to redevelop urban neighborhoods, oftentimes with a bunch of outdated, obsolete real estate product that either due to contamination or functional obsolescence has to go. I've learned a heck of a lot about preservation through this process and certainly can appreciate the perspective. And that's really what this is about, is trying to do the best you can, given the constraints, whether that be environmental constraints due to contamination, infrastructure constraints, market constraints. This consultation is really about ferreting out what's the best you can do from a preservation perspective. So you study the area you're working in, looking for, you know, National Register eligible districts, National Register eligible buildings. You may very well find these things. And then the last bullet on this slide, I think, is one of the key ones. So the consultation is key, thinking that this is a process of trying to come to common ground between the state, federal, and local stakeholders. That's key. But this last bullet, avoid, minimize, and mitigate. I can't tell you how many times I had to cram that into my head. The SHPOs of the world, the NHPA, the preservation advocates, and it may actually be in the Preservation Act, it may be in our State Historic Preservation Act, but the general idea is they want you to, you should be trying to avoid adverse impacts on historic resources, and in this order, avoid them first. If you can't avoid them, minimize them and show them how you're minimizing them. And if you absolutely can't minimize them, if you have to have adverse effects on historic and cultural resources, then you must mitigate those impacts. So we'll go a little further into what all this means. This next slide is a very simple flowchart of the Section 106 review process. That federal undertaking notice to the SHPO really initiates that Section 106 process. You are then looking to identify these properties. If you find stuff, if you don't find anything that's eligible for a National Register, you go straight to the bottom. And on some sites, I've had, you know, this 106 process has been the exchange of maybe two or three letters. We've done the study. There's nothing of significance. SHPO concurs in another letter. You're done. However, the other route this can go is you find stuff that's eligible for National Register, and as soon as you get over to that box on the right that says Analyze Effects, you're in consultation. You're probably not in a vacuum, as much as you are going to want to be. You're not going to be able to be in a vacuum analyzing those effects. You might be able to write a report, or your consultant might be able to write a report on what you think those effects are, of demolition, of remediation, of changing grades, of any number of things. But that is going to be put into this hopper of consultation. The local stakeholders, your consulting parties, they may very well have a different perspective on what is or is not an adverse effect. The SHPO may get a shot at all these reports as well, and they can just say we don't agree. And that happened several times to me. So you're in this consultation, you're analyzing these effects, you have to work to resolve those effects, and you document the resolution of those effects in an MOA, a Memorandum of Agreement. It's also called a Programmatic Agreement. I believe ours for the 3M campus, now Beacon Bluff Business Center it's called. But for the 3M campus, ours is an MOA, a Memorandum of Agreement and Programmatic Agreement, due to some arcane legal rationale or programmatic rationale I don't understand. So you document the resolution of these effects in that MOA, and then you proceed to mitigation. We are almost done with our mitigation at this point, and I'll show you what that looks like in a second here. Okay, helpful strategies. So don't wait to engage these folks, whether it's the SHPO, whether it's your local preservation community. We've got a group here in Minnesota called the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. If you have federal money going into one of your projects of EPA nature like this, or probably any kind, and you have these sorts of eligible properties or districts, they're all going to know about it. I mean, it's all going to come out in the wash. And what I've found in working with across a number of these groups, a number of the historic professionals, it is that there's a bit of a it's not an inferiority complex, but there is a bit of a complex that they get the short shrift constantly. You know, when working with the private development community, what we hear from our local Heritage Preservation Commission, private developers come into these historic neighborhoods and tear this down and screw this up and don't ever ask. And then when we told them they were supposed to ask, they say they didn't know, and of course they did know if they're so sophisticated. So not asking or begging for forgiveness later is just never really a good idea, in my experience with this NHPA stuff. Don't wait to engage. Something else helpful to remember is, in my experience, EPA limits the Section 106 review to the work actually being funded by their brownfield dollars. So if it's an earthwork project, a remediation project, and you're taking a building down to get it some contamination to prepare the site for redevelopment, as we were doing, there were calls and claims that this federalizes the entire project. And now you have to walk through all these same steps because there's federal money in and it federalizes, even if you're just creating a blank slate, a vacant piece of dirt, and it might be 5 or 10 years before somebody builds on it. We were often told by folks across the table in this consultation that, well, you know, this federalizes your entire thing, And so now we have our teeth into you for design review of the new structures, et cetera, et cetera. You still might wind up at design review for new structures by the preservation community or by SHPO, but that's something that you could negotiate. All of this stuff is negotiated. This is one huge negotiation. It isn't necessarily a requirement, as I've experienced it. Your regional EPA staff can be your biggest allies. I can't tell you how many times Joe Duffesy, Mike Gifford, Kerry Cragen at Region 5 came in from Chicago, called from Chicago, wrote from Chicago to pull our fat out of the fire and make sure that we were doing what we were supposed to do, but that we weren't doing more than we needed to do. And you'll see how expensive some of this can get and what some of our concerns were in a second here. I would, if you're doing development, if you're doing redevelopment, which I think many of you probably are, make sure you understand the perspective of your historic and cultural resources consultant. The first consultant we had on board, we ultimately fired. It got to a point where it became clear this was an ideological effort on their part. They were not interested in helping us get to our goal of redeveloping the site. And we had to bring someone on board that could show us they had experience in walking us through this process and getting to the point we had a project that was viable at the end of the day. I think we're all ultimately held to a standard of doing something productive with this land at the end of the day. And you'll see how hard we tried to get there a number of different ways. If this consultation goes badly, which it seems like it does from time to time, and then it comes back together, but if it goes really badly and if people aren't satisfied, the SHPO can appeal to the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation in Washington, D.C. My understanding is when they get involved, it's typically on much more high-profile projects, much more controversial projects. It's not a gun they like to bring out very easily, but I think that's when you've got to start worrying about, am I doing something that's jeopardizing my funding here? And the last thing that's been very helpful is we have been able to use EPA grants to help pay for some of these mitigation measures. So what are some of these realities of National Historic Preservation Act and Section 106 review? I think in all, our total Section 106 time frame to reach a signed memorandum agreement was plus or minus 1 year. And that was running hard. Part of the way I eventually came to look at this process is probably, not, because it's such a consultative negotiation, and that's almost all that's required is the negotiation to if you're going to impact these resources as to how to mitigate them. You can eventually get there. This process likely will not or probably almost cannot stop your project, but it can certainly drag it out to a point that it kills it, or it can make it so expensive to a point that it kills it. One of the ways in which we really pushed the end of this negotiation on the MOA, which could have gone on ad nauseum, was the fact we had a second phase of acquisition. And we were very clear from the outset that if we didn't have a negotiated MOA that we could live with, that we could still base a project around, by the time our due diligence period was expiring on the second phase of acquisition, we just weren't going to buy it. And ultimately, this neighborhood and the other stakeholders really did want to see this property turn into something other than it was. It was about to become 1.5 million square feet in the middle of a neighborhood that would have been boarded up, vacant, and just a huge blight. So what were our negotiated results? We were eventually able to demolish, it's actually more like 1.5 million square feet of functionally obsolete buildings and do a bunch of remediation. All these parcels had contamination on it. Some of it 3M put there, and we held their feet to the fire. They're still paying to clean stuff up out there. Some of it that predated 3M even, we went after. We were able to save and secure Building 21, the World Headquarters building, cute little two-story Art Deco thing, about 75,000 square feet out of the 1.5 million. But the rest of those structures, there's millions of square feet of them in the marketplace, and try it as we might, they are just not attractive in the modern industrial real estate marketplace. We were able to remove a non-functional but a very landmark water tower, about 100-foot-tall water tower, right in the middle of a parking lot, which was, of course, right in the middle of a very wonderful development parcel. It's now the largest shovel-ready industrial parcel in the city of St. Paul. We'll put 200,000 square feet of building on it and 200 to 300 people back to work at it. And we were able to reconfigure and remove parts of the street and the grid system that really didn't work. There's a diagonal road coming through the site. It created a lot of awkward 5-6-way intersections. So we did some infrastructure work as part of all this as well. What did those results require of us in terms of a mitigation plan? You know, it wasn't gun to your head, you must do a building reuse study, but it was quite clear that if SHPO and our local preservation community was going to get comfortable with us taking these buildings down and sign anything, they wanted to know damn sure that we had done everything we could to analyze the financial capacity of these structures to be reused. So we spent about $750,000. We engaged a team of architects, engineers, cost estimators, contractors, and we basically did fit studies and pro forma analysis on, I think, just about every one, every square foot of that 1.5 million square feet to show the cost versus value implications of reusing those buildings. Even after we did that, the only way we could get to a signed agreement was if we agreed to market those buildings for an additional 2 years. This was after 3M had them in the marketplace for 1.5 years. The only way we could get to yes was to put up some additional time we were willing to try and let the market find an adaptive reuse for these structures. That cost us $350,000. The reason it cost us $350,000 to market these buildings, we went to the real estate brokerage community, who we work with on sourcing deals all the time, and said, guys, we've got these buildings. Will you market them for us? They said, sure, but we don't think we're ever going to sell them, so we know there's never going to be a commission, so we'll market them for you on an international basis. We'll turn over every stone. We've got, you know how these brokers talk, we've got 50,000 brokers all over the world that can expose this to millions of companies and all that crap. Well, at the end of the day, they knew there wasn't going to be a commission, and so they said, we'll market this for you internationally, but you're going to pay us a flat fee every month for 2 years, and that's about what it added up to. The piece we're working on right now and the piece that I'm really excited, after a lot of heartburn several years ago over this stuff, I'm really excited about the Historic Interpretive Program that is out to bid right now and will be installed yet this fall. It's 27 historic interpretive panels. It's costing about $300,000. That's engineer's estimate. We'll see where bids come in here in about 2 weeks. The next slide, this just shows what those interpretive panels are. Those are little seat walls on the sides of this panel. This is a big thing. I can't remember how big this particular one is. What is it? 3 feet by 6 feet almost. So this is a big old panel. This is outdoors. The sign base itself, when we took down the 8-story office tower, we salvaged about 100 limestone panels, Indiana limestone. We pulled them off the building before we demoed the building, and now those will be recut, replaned, and recrafted, and that salvaged historic material will be used to create the base of these very significant, pretty large seat structures around these signs. This is one of the panels itself, sourced largely out of the Minnesota Historical Society archives. It needed to, of course, tell the story of 3M during the period of significance. Period of significance is something you will come to learn and understand in this world. The character-defining features of these buildings, these are all terms that mean a lot in the world of NHPA in Section 106. But we had to tell this story about 3M and its relationship with the neighborhood. So we developed this over the course of a year, brought it back to the community, brought it back to SHPO, added some more stories about the local high schools and labor and the war and all sorts of little tidbits from that 50-year chunk of 3M's period of significance in St. Paul. So this is why I'm so excited. This was about 2 weeks ago. We had the grand opening of what we call the hub. And so the white sign you see those two people standing in front of, that's actually a temporary interpretive panel. We put it up 2 weeks ago just particularly for our grand opening event. But when we realized we had already built a little half-acre plaza in the middle of this development, and that's where these historic interpretive panels were going to go, we also realized we were doing pretty cool things with next-generation stormwater management, carbon footprinting of all the buildings out here, and we wanted to tell that story as well. So really, what we crafted was an umbrella interpretive program under a concept we coined an educational streetscape, and that interpretive program now tells the story of 3M in the neighborhood, but it also tells the story of stormwater management and modern stormwater management, how we do it right, which is the purpose of those three big arcs there. The hydrologic cycle, the candy cane-looking thing in the front, that's a sculpture that tells the story about the hydrologic cycle. So we really saw this as an opportunity to do some creative placemaking that we really had never done before and that we probably wouldn't take as many lumps doing the work we do, some of the tough redevelopment work we do, if we were more known for doing stuff like this than tearing stuff down. The last thing I'll show you, you see that railing in front, the curved silver railing? You see little tiny boxes on them. Well, these are little artist-made cast plates that turtle slides upwards to the cloud. The trash can slides upwards to the rain as well, and it triggers water that shoots out of the cloud molecule, the water molecules at the top of each Corten steel arc. That water then falls on either natural surface, concrete with the big rusty beehive you see there, or on a filter pave infiltration engineered surface. And that's where we tell the story of next generation stormwater management. So, you know, as much of a headache as this NHPA stuff can be, at the end of the day, you know, as a professional, I think I came to appreciate those perspectives quite a bit more in my daily work. We found an opportunity to use our mitigation measures to really do some specific placemaking work, creative placemaking work. I finally figured out what those two words mean, I think. It's taken several years, but we think this is the sort of stuff that really adds amenities and adds to the value of the property and the attractiveness of the neighborhood for investment. So at the end of the day, it is a good story, and we really appreciate EPA's funding, of course, but really without the technical experts and the assistance of the folks at Region 5, this one would have been a pretty tough deal by ourselves.
Okay, thanks so much, Monty. That was really helpful. In the interest of time, I think we'll just have time for maybe one question. We have three more sections to get to, but if folks have any questions for Monty, that was really interesting. Anything that comes to mind, feel free to unmute your phone by pressing #6 and ask away. Okay. Well, if you think of other questions as we're going along for Monty, his contact information is in the slides, or you can also just type into chat on the left-hand side of your screen, and we will answer it. Thanks again, Monty. That was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan.
Okay. So our next section of fine print is the Endangered Species Act, and I'm just certainly no expert, so I just kind of wanted to give the 30,000-foot version. This is adapted from other Endangered Species Act presentations we've given about to our RLF audiences in the past. But it is something that you need to consider as you're signing off on these RLFs, or excuse me, executing these RLFs or loans or subgrants. So just really quick, the typical sequence of events is, of course, familiarizing yourself with the project and then going on to the Fish and Wildlife Service website. They have this great website, and it's called, I think IPAC stands for something about the project area or initial project area. But you can go to that website and enter your county or your city or your area where your project is and see if there are any potential threatened or endangered species within that exact project area. And you'll review that information, and if there are none, you know, you're done. If there is something that is potentially identified as threatened or endangered species within your project area, you would begin an informal consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service and work with your EPA project officer. So that's just sort of, as I said, the very high-level version, but just to make sure you're aware of this requirement in your terms and conditions. The second to last piece before we go over acres and your reporting requirements is to just remind everyone about your Davis-Bacon requirements, and also as a reminder of what the Davis-Bacon Act is. It requires that any laborers, mechanics that are employed by contractors at your cleanup sites that are involved in construction, repair, alteration, be paid a locally prevailing wage. So in order to ensure you're complying with Davis-Bacon, definitely look at your terms and conditions. We have specific terms and conditions for cleanups, specific Davis-Bacon terms and conditions for cleanups that are paid for with the RLF subgrants or loans. So you'll certainly want to review those and see if DBA, if the Davis-Bacon Act will apply to your tasks and go from there. So that's your step number one. Your step number two is to visit, oops, that's kind of covering up the thing there, but to obtain wage determinations, and that's available at that website. I'll take the picture off of that. Sorry about that. But it's the labor website that has the wage determinations for it, and it'll be specific to your geographic area and to different types of construction. And I believe most brownfields projects are going to fall under heavy construction. These are modified periodically, so certainly check back with every new project that is initiated under your grantee, and it, of course, needs to be included in any of the contract documents, the prevailing wage that's listed on that site. So what's your recipient or your role as an RLF recipient? You need to conduct on-site interviews. You need to conduct spot checks of payrolls, report any potential violations, and this is very important to maintain full documentation for many years after the grant. After the project, excuse me. What are your borrower or subgrantee roles? They need to obtain the wage determinations from Department of Labor at that website, ensure that they're in any sort of contract documents. This is a biggie, post the Davis-Bacon notice and any applicable wage rates at the project site, and ensure that they are submitting the certified payrolls to you, the grantee. Some common problems, I think the biggest one, or at least the one I hear the most about, is inadequate record keeping. We have an IG audit going on right now where they are finding that there aren't good records of how often they checked back on the wage rates and if the laborers were being paid those wage rates. So really, really important to keep good records, not only ensuring that your subgrant or grantee or borrower is complying, but also that they're keeping records of that compliance. And then a reminder to post that Davis-Bacon poster that can that can get folks in trouble as well. So to remind folks, the reason we're kind of just giving a very high-level overview of Davis-Bacon is because we've recently done an entire webinar devoted to Davis-Bacon. It's posted on our website. I would strongly encourage folks to review all of those slides. It goes into a lot more details. And if you have questions, certainly talk to your project officers about complying with this. So before we move on to our last topic, I know we just have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure we have time for ACRES, but are there any questions on Endangered Species Act or Davis-Bacon? And to unmute your phone, you can hit #6.
Question on Davis-Bacon.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the wage determination and no one knows where the job falls and Department of Labor and other people don't know where to direct you to, how do you actually find out where that job falls in the wage determination?
Hi. You can go to DOL and ask for them to determine what the prevailing wage would be for that job classification. I'm sorry, I can't remember what it's called right off the top of my head, but they can actually come up with the prevailing wage. How they do that is they go out and survey so many employers in that area, and they will come back and tell you. That process takes a little while, so it's a lot better if you can find it in one of the listings.
Are there other questions? Okay, then with that, we will move on to our final presenter, Frank Gardner of EPA Region 1, and to go over ACRES reporting. And Frank, you should have control of the slides, but feel free. Can you get them? Okay.
See. Let me try again here. 1 second. About.
Do you want me to just hit them?
I do want to show my ACRES screen. But go ahead and advance this one, and let's see how it works.
Okay. Yeah. We might just have to actually hit the arrow. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Frank.
So for RLF, I'm assuming everyone on the call has used ACRES, hopefully, unless you're a new recipient just about to get your grant. So I'm not going to get into all the stuff about how you get into ACRES and why we do it. Just going to focus on, in the limited time, focus on some of the key things that come up specific to RLF. And the first one is, when should you associate a new property to your grant? Sometimes we've had RLF recipients associate a couple, three new properties they thought they were going to work on, and then some of them didn't work out, the borrowers backed out or whatnot, and now we have a property record associated to a grant when we're not really going to fund anything. And it's kind of a hassle to undo that. So basically, the advice here is wait until the loan or the subgrant document is issued, so that the loan agreement is signed or the subgrant agreement is signed. At that point is when we recommend associating that property record to your revolving loan fund grant. Okay, so that might be pretty far down the road, you know, when that happens. The next thing is when to show a cleanup start date. That's when you actually would show the amount of funding you're putting on the project is when you enter the cleanup start date. And that's not going to actually happen until really the second bullet there, when cleanup activities start in the field. So you're going to do the community relations plan, you're going to do the ABCA, you're going to get the CWAP submitted and approved by EPA, public comment period. All that stuff's going to happen probably before any cleanup activities actually start in the field. So, again, it might have a fairly lengthy lapse while that whole cleanup planning process unfolds. And then the cleanup finally starts, and that's when you enter that cleanup start date and show your cleanup funding and potentially other funding hitting that project, that cleanup project. And the other thing that sometimes comes up here is in some cases your revolving loan fund grant may be funding a project that was also funded with one of our cleanup grants. So it's important to be aware of that when that happens, and the cleanup grant recipient is responsible for entering their data, but you're responsible for entering your data. And it's always good to look at the property homepage to see what they've already entered. They may have already entered a cleanup start date. Hopefully it's correct, you know, and you can enter that same date to show that it's the same project and you're just two different funders for it, if that's the case. Let's go ahead and see what's on the next slide, Megan. The next step, the next time you be going in likely would be when the cleanup is done in the field. But again, keep in mind that just because the cleanup activities are done in the field doesn't necessarily mean we have what's defined as a cleanup completion. Cleanup completion is defined as the date that the cleanup is documented as being complete. And so how is a cleanup documented as being complete? It's usually, it depends on your state. In many states, it's a no further action letter or a cleanup completion letter from your state environmental authority. In some places, it might be the final report submitted by the qualified environmental professional saying that they've, you know, documenting that they've completed the cleanup to state standards. So it's that date of the documentation that memorializes the cleanup as being complete that we're entering as the cleanup completion date. Want to talk a little bit about institutional controls as well. There's a couple questions in ACRES about institutional controls. And when you get to the point of entering a cleanup completion date, we really want you to take a good look at those questions and make sure they're answered accurately. Particularly with institutional controls, even if you show a cleanup completion date, but then if you show incomplete information on institutional controls, the system won't tally your property and your acreage as being quote-unquote ready for reuse. For example, if the answer to are institutional controls required is yes, but then the question says are they in place, if that's blank or no, then the system will assume that there's more that needs to be done here and the site isn't really ready for reuse. So the institutional controls questions are important as well. What's next? Let's look at the next slide, Megan. And click again. This should add another bullet to it.
I'm sorry. You want me to click it again?
See if you click it again. Is there another?
Oh yeah, I see.
Okay. So this shows kind of how the sites are related. It's your RLF grant is the box on the left here, and on top RLF loans/subgrants. And you might be showing activity on a variety of sites. You know, 57 Chestnut Street, Frank's Automotive. And some of these sites may also be receiving funding from other sources. So in the case of Frank's Automotive here, you can see that property is also benefiting from a cleanup grant, which is probably belongs to some other entity other than you. And so it's just, again, recognizing that you may be one of several funders or multiple funders funding the cleanup project. And one important thing to keep in mind there, say for this case of Frank's Automotive, if the site is redeveloped and there's a bunch of redevelopment dollars leveraged to report, that's great. But if there's two different grants funding the cleanup, yours and the cleanup grant, say to the town or somebody, sometimes it requires a little coordination to see who's going to report what under the leveraged accomplishments. We had an example in Rhode Island where a brownfield was redeveloped and a brand new $80 million school was built, which was great. We had four different funders that funded that project. There was a cleanup grant, and there were two different revolving loan funds, and the state with 128A funding all funded the cleanup, which is great, but they all reported the $80 million school. So in total, we reported a $320 million school, because if different people report leveraging, it just adds that up. So we had to get people talking and say, okay, who's going to report what? So if you're one of multiple funders on a project, it's good to coordinate that. And let's see what else we have. Next slide, please. I think we talked about that. Let's jump ahead. I know we're short on time. Let's skip that slide. Recent enhancements. The main thing I wanted to focus on there, and I don't know if you can see my I'd called up Acres. Let me try one more time to see if you can see. Can people see my Acres screen at all or no?
No, but maybe I can stop sharing and I can try.
Oh, wait, let me go
can
to
share
my screen.
Can you share your screen now?
I'm going to share my screen now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's try that. And let's see, can people see my Acres screen now?
I can see the Windows screen. I can't see the Acres screen.
Let me try this.
Oh, yeah, you got to drag it in.
There we go.
There you go.
Okay, I wanted to show you guys one thing. When you go to, and I'm just going to pick on, I just happen to have a work package here for an RLF project. And when you guys are entering cleanup information in Acres, we've added a couple of new things with regard to funding, and this is really, really important to you guys in the RLF community. So here, you've entered a cleanup activity start date. So the cleanup started on May 2013. That's great. And then down here for cleanup funding, I'm going to go to Update Funding to show you the options under cleanup funding. It's just taking a minute to pop up. Oh, here we go. Let me drag it over. Okay. So this is what comes up when you click on Update Funding. And you can see in this case, the recipient entered a Brownfields RLF grant funds loaned. So they took $800,000 of their federal grant funds and loaned them out to this project. And that's great. And they got the date of the loan agreement here. Perfect. However, it's not always that simple. There are other options. It could be, and if you can see this pop-up window, there's four key options I want you to focus on here. Grant funds loaned, grant funds subgranted. So again, you can take our federal grant dollars and you can loan them or you can subgrant them. And sometimes it's a combination. It could be $50,000 of each if it's a combination loan and subgrant. The next two options are new, program income loaned and program income subgranted. So this is when you get program income that comes back in the door, someone repays a loan or whatnot, and then you send that money back out on another project, either loaning it or subgranting on another project. It's important to select these as options. So let's say if for this project, we also loaned out $200,000 of program income. Okay. Now it shows you've got a $1 million project, $800,000 of which was federal grant funds, $200,000 of program income. You've now just documented a key milestone. You've now just documented that you are indeed revolving, right? That's the whole point of a revolving loan fund program is to loan money out, get it back, and then loan it back out or subgrant it back out as new projects. Here's where you show us that that's the case. And this becomes really important when people want to do things like ask for supplemental funding. It's a way to stand out and show that you're really revolving. So keep this in mind next time you report a project, these different options for funding going out the door. Okay, those are the first four. There's also one for cost share. So you can show when a recipient, a loan recipient or subgrant recipient, is kicking in some money towards the project, document that cost share. Same idea. So maybe for this recipient, they're kicking in $100,000 of additional cleanup above and beyond the million that they're paying for with another source, and we're going to apply that to our cost share. Okay? So these are the kind of things you need to think about when you're reporting funding. I think that's pretty much the main stuff I wanted to go over, and I know we're just about out of time.
Great. Thanks, Frank. So I hope we're right at 3 o'clock Eastern time, so we'll wrap up. Did people have any questions for Frank on Acres reporting? I saw one. Someone had typed in if we could give an example of an institutional control, and I just had typed back that those are administrative or legal controls, like a zoning restriction, that's what we mean by institutional control. So that's the answer to that question. Are there other questions about Acres reporting at this time? You can unmute your phone by pressing #6. Okay, well, you have all of our contact information, and as I said, these slides will be available along with the checklist in the next day or so, posted on our website, and I'll send the link out to your project officers so they can get it to you. We really appreciate you taking the time to join. We hope that this overview of some of the more fine print aspects of the RLF program has been helpful. Again, please don't hesitate to share with us any feedback, other items you'd like us to elaborate on, other topics you want us to cover this summer or fall in upcoming RLF webinars. For those of you who have submitted RLF supplemental requests, we are in the process of making those decisions, so you should know by the end of the month. We couldn't get the money together as quickly as we have in the past couple of years, so that's why we're about a month behind schedule. We just were trying to get as much money as possible into the supplemental pool, so you should be hearing about those decisions by the end of the month, beginning of August, okay? And again, feel free to contact me, I'm Megan Quinn, or any of our speakers for follow-up questions, and thank you very much for joining us. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.